It's always a delight to come to Canada because, you know, to teach us unruly New Yorkers how to behave. And I am particularly grateful to the Institute for Marriage and Family Canada for their amazing generosity. And I'm so excited that there's a present. That's for me, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So thank you so much, Andrea and Dave and everybody at the Institute for your hospitality and generous invitation for me to speak here. My talk is going to be in three parts. I don't know why, but just turned out that way. I'm going to start by looking at what we know about the connection between family breakdown and poverty and inequality from the research in the United States. I'm going to then go into a discussion of my understanding, my interpretation, my theory about why this connection exists. And then finally, in a short period of time, I'll make a few tentative remarks about Canada based on what I admit to be somewhat limited expertise, which I hope you will feel free to correct. Now, almost all Americans can cite statistics about the breakdown in the family in their country, and let's see if I can... There we go. Okay. They will tell you with a kind of a shrug, kind of a rueful shrug, a kind of, you know, shake of the head like that. Half of all marriages end in divorce. That's probably right. The numbers are still disputed, but it's somewhere around half. A third of all children, actually the number has gone up since I first wrote these words some time ago. A third of all children are born to mothers who are not married. It's now seems to be creeping up to about 37%, and I predict will be around 40% within a few years. And there's been a threefold increase in the proportion of children growing up in single-parent families over the past 40 years. Now, Americans, like I said, you know, they're kind of casual, relaxed about this. I wouldn't say that they think it's of no interest or no importance, but it's not not much you can do about it, not much to make of it anyway. But I think if they understood how misleading this data is, they might have a different attitude. Because in recent years, researchers have begun to disaggregate these numbers in ways by income and education. And let me show you what they've found. Okay. 50 years ago, just about everyone got married before they had their children. Everyone, whether they were black or white, poor or rich, didn't matter. You got married before you had your kids. And there was not any difference between the way a high school educated, a woman with, who hadn't graduated high school, and a woman who had gotten her college degree, went about the whole marriage and baby business. But if you look here, you'll see, let's see if I can figure out how to use that. There we go. Along around 1960, right, you see there's beginning to be a change in all three lines. Now, to clarify, the gray line is a high school graduate. The black line, no high school, and then this dotted line here is college educated. So, around 1960, all three of these groups began to experiment with the idea of having children outside of marriage. By 1970, it started to go way up. Now, you'll notice, though, there's a big difference here between the college educated mothers and mothers with a high school diploma and mothers with no high school diploma. Despite the fact that there's been a lot of talk in our country about, I don't know if it reached here or not, the Murphy-Brown phenomenon, is that a phrase that you all know? And despite the Angelina Jolies and the Madonnas and people like that, the fact is that the large majority of single mothers are have less education. All right, college-educated mothers get married before they have their kids. That's a generalization that pretty much holds out. It's somewhere around 4 or 5% of college-educated mothers have their children outside of marriage. Look at how different that is for those with with no college education. Now, there was a very similar divergence in divorce trends. Once again, we've got the college educated here. We've got the high school educated here, and then the black line is the high school diploma. So look what happened. Long around 1960, we started to get a divorce fever, right? There was a lot of new divorces at that time. And this kept on going through about 1980. And then something very interesting happened. College-educated women stopped divorcing. And in fact, they were even divorcing in much fewer numbers than they had been in 1970. That was not the case with their less educated sisters, who continued to divorce at large rates, although it did start to break off here in the late 90s, which is something that I'll mention in a few minutes. I'll try to explain what was going on there. Now, the upshot of these two trends is what I call the marriage gap. By 2000, only 10% of mothers with a college degree or more were living without husbands. I always, whenever I read that number, I always puzzle because I seem to be related or friends with an unusual percentage of those people. If you compare that to the 36% of women without a college degree who are living without husbands, you can see the marriage gap. As Christopher Jenks and David Elwood, both professors at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, and whose research I've relied on, conclude, this is a quote, "The rise in single-parent families is concentrated among blacks and the less educated. It hardly occurred at all among women with a college degree." Now, this would be a kind of interesting but not terribly significant demographic fact, I suppose, except for one thing, which is that we know now from decades of research that children do better when they grow up with their parents. How's that? You can hear me now, right? Okay. So let's start with the economics of this, the implications of this marriage gap. There we go. Children growing up in single-parent families are far more likely to be poor. 36% of single female-headed families are poor. That's compared to 6% of married couple families. All right, that's quite a big difference. And here's another way to look at it, which I have here. If you look at the different quintiles of income here, these again, this bar here is living with one parent. The jazzy bar here is living with your married parents. And look at what happens. The bar gets consistently smaller as you go up the income scale. And the opposite is the case for children growing up with their married parents. It gets bigger and bigger. So we have 92% of children whose families make over $75,000 are living with their two parents. On the other end, only 20% of children living under $15,000 are living with both parents. Let's think about it in a slightly different way. All right? There's a number of studies showing that the increase in single-parent homes explains much of the rise in child poverty rates in the United States. I have a few here, Thomas and Sawhill. They say restoring marriage to 1960 levels would cut child poverty by a third, right? And then another one which says changes in family structure explain 37% of the increase of poverty and the increase in significantly more than the effect of stagnating median wages. Everybody in the United States is very happy to talk about stagnating median wages. They are not so happy to talk about the marriage issue. But it's not just poverty that's at stake here. What we now know, as I said, from decades of research, is that you can control for education, for income, for race, for the number of siblings. Children from single-parent families, both as a result of divorce and as a result of non-marriage, are more prone to just about every social problem that social science has looked into. School failure, delinquency, crime, early pregnancy, emotional difficulties, and a host of other problems. At this point, the evidence that family structure is perhaps the greatest risk factor for children is so powerful that, as James Q. Wilson, one of our eminent political scientists in the United States, has joked, even sociologists believe it. Now, researchers have found that single mothers tend to be less child-centered. So, you know, sometimes when I read this, people, I think, take it that I'm criticizing individual single mothers. That's not what I'm saying here. I'm saying structurally there's a problem when you have a single-parent family. They tend to be less child-centered, not because they're bad mothers or don't want to do well by their children, but simply because they've got too much on their plate. Their children tend to watch more TV, probably for the same reasons. They don't oversee homework as much as married mothers do. And there is an important and related fact. The children of single mothers are less likely to go to college, and when they do, they are less likely to go to an elite college. There's a professor at Cornell in the States, a very elite college, who was very puzzled one day when she was talking to her class, and I think it was in sociology, and she looked around and she realized that only a very small number of her students came from divorced families. And she wondered, well, how could that be? Because we have a 50% divorce rate. This should be about half these kids should be from divorced families. No, it was something like 10%. So she went to a colleague at Cornell. They both agreed they were finding the same thing. They then looked at the data from other elite colleges in the United States, and lo and behold, they found the same thing. Something like 10% of the kids at these elite colleges were from divorced families. All right, because the children who did not grow up with their two biological parents were only half as likely to go to a selective college. Now, the implications of this in our present economy are just immense. You know, at one time, if you said there was a group of kids who were less likely to go to college, you might react that it wasn't much of a big deal because, after all, you could go get a decent job in a factory or something like that. You didn't even have to graduate high school, and yet education just was not central to having a middle-class life. That is no longer the case. So we have what I think of as a kind of perfect storm between the growth of what economists call the knowledge economy and the breakdown of the family, if you see what I'm saying. The knowledge economy means that college education becomes ever more important to achieve a successful life in the United States. At the same time, the breakdown of the family occurs where fewer children are going to be able to go to college because they are not growing up with their two married parents. So that two-pronged storm, as it were, really has reinforced the marriage gap in a very profound way. And by the way, this knowledge economy that I'm talking about is also the reason why young people are getting married so much later than they used to, because it takes so much longer to finish your training, to get your education, to get your foothold into your career, that the average age of marriage now is 25 for women, 27 for men. That's in the United States. I think it's rather similar here. And the average age of marriage for college-educated men and women is considerably higher. So there's a whole new demographic that I'm actually doing a lot of work on right now, which are these young 20-somethings and 30-somethings, sometimes called emerging adults. I'm not crazy about the term, but that's something that has evolved out of this knowledge economy. But the point for those people, for the college-educated people, is not they will not marry. As I've said before, the college-educated women are far more likely to marry and far less likely to divorce. Now, there's All of this that I've been telling you is pretty problematic, but there's even worse news, and that is that the children of single parents are far more likely to become single parents themselves. That means that single parenthood and all of the problems attending it is self-perpetuating. That's why I call it my theory, Marriage and Caste in America. Right? That is why I talk about a marriage gap. On one side of the gap, you have well-educated women who are going to be making money, so they get married, then and only then do they have their children, and they raise those children with their husbands. Those children are more likely to grow up, to be well-adjusted, to do well in school, to go to college, to marry, and only then have children. On the other hand, we have low-income women raising children alone who are more likely to remain low-income. Those children are more likely to drop out of school, or if they do make it to college, to go to a less elite college and to become single parents themselves. That is why I argue that marriage, when you look at these numbers, poses an even larger social divide in the United States than race. Now, let's see what's next here. Why does marriage make such a big difference, right? The usual explanation is what I call the strength in numbers theory. Right? And the strength in numbers theory goes like this. You've got two people, and that's better, given how hard it is to raise kids, that's better to have two people, right? Two people are better than one because it's just a lot of work. The married couples have two incomes in many cases. They have two sets of eyes and hands. They have two brains to problem solve when little Johnny has locked himself in the bathroom and the water is running. But there are several reasons to question this strength in numbers theory. Now, first, children from step families, that is, where there are two parents, but one parent is not the biological parent, don't look, on the research, they don't look a whole lot better than those from single mother households. This is on average, of course. True, those kids are not as likely to be poor as the children growing up with single mothers. But they have more problems in school, they have more problems with drugs, more problems with early sexual activity, more problems with going to college. Now, you might say, okay, we can put that theory aside just because those kids had to suffer through a divorce. Perhaps they had emotional problems because of that. But there's another fact that doesn't fit the strength in numbers theory. By the way, I should say, there's something to the strength in numbers theory. It just doesn't take us far enough. But the other reason to question it is this. At least in the United States, children living with cohabiting parents also don't look any better than kids growing up with single mothers. And I'll be going back to this point in a moment. Now, the strength in numbers theory misses something really important. Marriage isn't just about two people falling in love, promising to stay together, and figure out how to get the kid out of the bathroom when the bathtub is running. It isn't just about that. Yet Americans, and from what I've been able to gather looking at the internet and being here in Canada, Canadians as well, tend to think of marriage as primarily as just this relationship. Two adults decide to make public their love and commitment in a ceremony that these days will take you to the poorhouse. When that relationship sours, the marriage is over. Marriage is personal. Well, yes. But the impact of the breakdown of marriage on children and on the rest of society proves that it is so much more than that. It is what thinkers often call a social institution, but what I've begun to think of is a little like software for the human brain. It gives people megabytes of necessary information about how to live. Now let me explain what I mean. We all know marriage is a universal institution. That is, every society has some form of marriage. And as a universal institution, it tells parents, it tells people what their rights and responsibilities are to their children, among other things. It tells you a lot of other things, but that is one of the primary things it says. Now, modern Western marriage, that is, marriage in Western Europe and North America, has served many purposes, but one of them has been to tell people how to organize their lives. It's a little like MapQuest. Marriage is the destination, and yes, but there are a series of steps that you need to take in order to get there. And I think of it as the middle class life script. Marriage tells you how to follow the middle class life script. You go through childhood, you enter adolescence, you get into your early adulthood these days, preparing for work, through schooling, through an early apprenticeship and that sort of thing. You at least finish high school. Only then do you marry, and only then, after you marry, do you have your children. That's the script that was implanted in everybody's brains. It's not that your parents had to teach it to you. They didn't sit down one day and say, here's the middle class life script. You just absorbed it from the culture around you. Okay, that's one thing that a culture does. It provides a map, a life script. But it carries also a set of other ideals and beliefs that turn out to be crucial to flourishing. The marriage script says children need their mothers and fathers, and vice versa. Children need a great deal of nurturing. It also says that parents need to devote themselves to the children's social and emotional and cognitive development. And that in our current economic environment, that mission, as I often call it, becomes ever more important. That is the development of the child to become a competent worker. Now, Western marriage, particularly Anglo-American marriage, has always been tied up also with private property and the accumulation of wealth. Historically, to marry, young men had to have a plot of land to set up an independent housekeeping. And this was very different from other cultures where young people just moved in with parents. Right? In the Anglo-American world, the idea was that you were going to be independent, self-sufficient, as we often say in the United States, self-governing. You had to make more money in order to marry. And then when you married, you were a kind of joint economic unit, earning, sharing, saving for home owning, vacation going, and all of that. That's all part of the marriage, the middle class life script, the software in the brain that I'm talking about. Now, there is all kinds of research showing how much marriage is connected with the accumulation of wealth. The net wealth of married couples grows 16% a year on average in the United States, although it may be that we're going to have to revise some of these figures these days. But after 15 years, their wealth is 93% higher than for the singles and divorce, and you can see the attribution there. Married men earn 10 and between 10 and 40% more than single men. What I'm suggesting to you is that's because the marriage script, the middle class life script with marriage at its center, is also oriented around accumulating wealth. Now, low income, less educated men and women no longer have this script. It's been erased. It's gone. Right? When you talk to young women or young men in the inner city or in poor neighborhoods outside of the city, and you ask them, should you be married before you have your children, they will often look at you very puzzled, like, well, why would that matter? What's the difference? My mother raised me fine, you'll often hear. I've done some research talking to people in the inner city and asking about their attitudes towards marriage and childbearing. And when you ask young women, single mothers, if they had intended to have their children, because this is an assumption in the United States, people like to think that we're very rational and, you know, people make decisions how to live their lives and in a very thoughtful way. But when you ask young women, well, did you want to get pregnant? Did you want to have a baby? They'll say, well, sort of, or kind of, or, well, maybe this wasn't the perfect time, but it's okay. So, it's not either rational or not. It's simply something that people kind of fall into. If you try asking a middle-class 24-year-old what they foresee, where they foresee themselves being in 10 years, they will likely have a series of thoughts for you about where they want to be during their adulthood. That is not the case with many people living in low-income communities. There's no sense, very little sense of having goals and aspirations towards which you make step by step by step. It's remarkable to me that only 8% of those who follow the middle class life script that I've just been describing, that is, those who at least graduate high school and who marry before they have their children, only 8% of them are poor. 79% of those who do not follow the middle class life script are poor. Now, I would argue that this script is vitally important, not just for people of marriageable age, but for children and adolescents. It tells them where they are going and what matters. The pursuit of a hopefully permanent partner is an essential project for the young. It forces them to know themselves, to consider how they want to live, to plan their careers, to think about how they might want to build wealth for a comfortable life. It builds self-restraint and self-knowledge. In other words, it's not just about, oh, someday I'm going to get married. It also encourages people to think, okay, well, who am I going to be marrying? What kind of person am I going to be looking for? What kind of person do I want to be? So I think that the middle class life script isn't just a way of avoiding poverty. It is also a way of taking a more deliberate approach to life that is common to the middle class ideal.